I'm Stephanie Overbuck.
I'm Mel Wymore.
And this is Pot of Gold.
In last week's episode, we spoke with Will Hackman about the importance of making climate change a personal issue for people. When we can see the impact of the climate crisis in our own lives, we become motivated to act. This has certainly become the case for Dominique Perret.
Dominique is known as the best freeride skier of this century. He's also a motivational speaker and filmmaker who spent his life adventuring from peak to peak, exploring parts of the world never touched by humans. On his journey, Dominique has noticed drastic changes to these environments as a result of climate change and has since become motivated to act on behalf of our planet.
We asked Dominique to share his personal story with climate change and what he thinks it'll take to get more people engaged on this critical issue.
Take a listen.
So my name is Dominique Perret. I live in Switzerland. I was born and raised in Switzerland. And I was born as a skier. Since I was a kid, I loved the snow. I loved the winter. And I was very privileged because I was born with a passion of skiing. So when I was a kid, I did some racing. You know, it's a little bit like the when you learn to play a music instrument, you make your les gammes. In French, we say les gammes, your trainings. And then for me, skiing was not about racing. The whole thing about skiing was not about being the best, about number one. To me, skiing was about adventure, was about going to new places. It was about making your own track. I mean, going in the forest, going in the off-piste, in the outdoor. And it was also about the philosophy I had was not to be the best, but was to give my best. And I really love that philosophy. And a lot of sports from today, like outdoor sports, are about to give you best and not to be the best, which is a very good philosophy that I really love. So after my study, I did some study of mechanical engineering. I decided to be a skier, and that was the late 80s, beginning of the 90s. So it was a brand new philosophy with the freeriding sports. And I started making movies, going to places where nobody have been before. And to me, that was the goal, you know, to ski places that have never been skied before. And very quickly, I realized that the weather was changing. We had a huge climate change. Where we could ski maybe 10 years ago, 15 years ago, was not possible anymore. So by being on a very remote places, I saw a lot of changes very, very rapidly. So already around 2000, I started making movie and started to talk about that. But the ski industry at that time, they didn't like it. They wanted to show the dream. They wanted to show how beautiful it was. They didn't really like to hear a sportsman saying, hey guys, something is wrong here. We need to change our behavior. And this is how I got into the climate change.
Well, Dominic, you're not just any kind of skier. You are a, just let's be specific, you are a free ride. So one of those, how should I say, one of those crazy people going 90 degrees downhill. I've seen you skiing and I was like, okay, not for me. But maybe you can explain a little bit what kind of skiing you do when you say places never been skied before.
Yes, again, it started as a kid, you know, when I started skiing in the forest. And then when I grew up, when I got a little older, I started doing that in the Alps to go steeper and steeper, to go on bigger mountains. And this is what I call the white planet. This is my white planet. So I try to ski almost everywhere. And you know, skiing is, and to me, is a beautiful sport. It's a great sport. You meet a lot of people. You travel, not only on top of the snow, but you travel a lot. And you have the privilege to see a lot with the nature. You know, you can, there's a lot of things to observe.
So when you started to notice climate change, what actually specific things did you notice? Was it, you know, just less snow, or were there other signs?
So the first time I was really shocked, I was filming with my friend Didier Lafond. We've been filming and working together very often. And we were in the Mont Blanc glacier, And so it was in 2000. And suddenly we realized that 10 years before, we've been very close to that place. But when we looked at the place, it would be impossible to imagine that we would have skied there, because the place we skied was like 100 meters higher, and it was in nothing. The ice had melted about 100 meters in 10, 15 years. Then we realized, oh my God, I mean, this is really happening. And that moment, because we had pictures from the same location 10 years before, that moment really made a click in my brain. Because, you know, every winter you lose a little bit, and you don't really see it. But when you come back 10 years later, same location, and you can see the gap, that really triggers something in my mind. And from that moment, I was really involved in climate change. And as a skier, I was trying to do my best.
2000, now 20 years, 21 years later, are you surprised by the lack of activity around climate change, or are you happy about how much activity there has been around climate change since then?
It's very sad. It's incredibly sad, because at that time, a little later, you had Al Gore and all these guys, you know, they were really pushing for it. They were really trying to get the climate change. At that time, we were talking about global warming, which was more frightening. And now it sounds very nice to say climate change. But at that time, I was very optimistic, because people like Al Gore, you know, like big names, I mean, like heavyweight fighters, could change things. But since, nothing happened. Nothing really happened. So it is very sad. I mean, things happen, but at a personal level. I've seen a lot of friends. I've seen a lot of people at our level doing a lot. But as a political level, it's a disaster. It's an absolute disaster. Nobody took the lead. And actually, all the politicians who took the lead, it was a bad move for them. You know, they lost a lot of voices, you know. So it's very sad. It is very sad.
Well, and why do you think they lost their voices? What happened?
I think for many people, they're not... And I understand, you know, if you live in Europe, you know, in south of France and all these places, you talk about global warming, doesn't, you know, for these people, doesn't change anything. You know, they don't believe in it. I think it's about the same in the U.S. You know, and you have a vast majority of people, they were not touched, and for them, it was very difficult to understand what it was. Actually, it was even nice, because you can be in short in March instead of May, and you would have very nice summer holidays, and maybe you will have a very nice Indian summer until November. So for these people, it was pretty nice. So for them, they were not very concerned about it. So I think this is why these politicians were whistleblower, but a little, not too early considering the climate, but too early considering the people. And they were not taking very seriously.
Dominic, I think you were one of the, or maybe even the first person I got to know in the professional arena, you know, who publicly, openly warned about global warming, what we now call climate change. Yeah, with your movies, and I remember your presentation, it's, I think, now almost 20 years ago, must be 2003 or something, I think, when we met, or when I saw this presentation, I thought, like, wow, you know, it's really fantastic. There must have been a personal moment for you when you realized and you said, hey, people don't really like it, or the company doesn't like it, you know, sponsors probably didn't like it. But there must be sort of a deeper moment when you realize, hey, this is happening. What you just said, right? These comparison between the 10 years, all of a sudden 100 meters of ice is gone. It did something with you, right? It, like, deep inside, where is there something, like an adaptation process, or how do you deal with that?
You know, I'm a very optimistic person, and I've been always trying to bring new ideas. And again, when I realized in 2000 about the problem we had, I decided, and I was the first athlete ever to become carbon positive. So since 2000, I was calculating my footprint for all the travels, all the filming, and then I was tripling the footprint with a fantastic foundation. It was called a BTRF. It's Borneo Tropical Rainforest. And again, these people were doing a great job, you know. They were raising funds to keep the native Indian in the forest. So if the people can stay in the forest with education and health, then the forest will stay. So what they've seen is that when people are leaving the forest to go in the city for education or health, then the forest is taken down. So this beautiful foundation was trying to put this fantastic project. We were financing, getting some money. And again, same thing, after 10 years, they couldn't raise enough money to keep all this this forest up. So then I became kind of very sad. And in 2014, 15, I realized that as only human, you like simple people, it's impossible to achieve really something. If we don't have the big politician people, if you don't have the pressure, it would be impossible. But it took me 15 years to believe that we could change things. But actually, if we are only by ourselves, it's impossible. We don't have enough weight. We don't have enough power. And especially if we look at the last 4 years in the U.S., it was a disaster for the whole climate change. Mm. So we need the politician to be back in that game. And I realized that as a simple skier, you can do a little bit. Maybe that makes you feel good, but it doesn't change much. You know, it doesn't change much.
To what extent do you think that kind of money plays a role, like in this slow action? For example, are there lobbyists involved that have shut down that activism, or somehow or another, the loss of momentum isn't just for lack of leadership; it's also probably some counter force happening right there.
Yes, you're right. I think there's a lot of counter forces because, you know, the oil and everything is a huge lobbying and it's very strong. And but I think now it will change. You know, when you see all the big tornadoes, when you see all the floods, when you see all these huge dramas, now people, they are touched, you know. If they were not very strongly touched, they don't really believe in the global warming. But as soon as people are physically touched or emotionally touched, they are in contact with it, then they start to believe in it. And then politicians can play a role because they get the voices. And then as soon as you have the politician, they will make new laws, new registrations, new norms, and the industry will follow. But it's very difficult to make the wheel start, you know. But I mean, look at New York. I see New York is a very good example because you had the big floods. They were the worst flood, and that was kind of a tipping moment where people started to understand, wow, this can touch us now, and it became something tangible. I don't know if you agree, but we have the same here. You know, when we have the drought. So people start thinking, okay, yes, it is happening. It's not just a hoax. It's not just. So I think this is what we need. You know, it's sad to say, but we need more drama for people to believe it's not a hoax, and then they will start to do something about it. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit human nature, huh? As soon as you're not, you know, in the wall, everything is fine, you know. But once you get hit, when you get hurt, then you start to do something about it.
You know, but it's so simple that, you know, the small incentives will go a long way to have people adopting greener technology. It's not that much that is required. Like in New York City, which where we actually have a very low carbon footprint, you know, when you calculate it, we have more energy being spent from cars, actually, than our building structures, because we're very dense. So a little heat, heats a lot of people, and it's not all green, but we've actually made a lot of effort in New York City to convert those fossil fuels into, you know, other types of heating. However, it's a long way to go. I admit that. But just a little incentive, we change our boiler, and it's only a little tax break, but it's enough for our community to make that decision. I just don't understand why it's not everywhere to have a little incentive to make this change.
Yeah, you know, it's now it's interesting in the Alps. We have some ski resorts. They want to be they want to be zero emission in 2030, and they already start to build. You know, to change like the snow machine, the snow made. They change also the chairlifts, and they are, I mean, and it's very nice. I think if ski resorts can be a good example, because you have, you know, you catch a lot of people with money, with decision. If they start to ski, the ski resort changing, maybe they will take this into the city and develop it. I hope so. But it's coming, but it's very slow. But, you know, again, why do ski resorts are kind of the first one? Because they have to. They have no choice. So when you don't have a choice, you make the effort. Because the ski resort, they have no choice. They have to change. So I think soon the city, and probably New York, will be one of the first, because they have to change. I mean, if not, they will be underwater very soon.
Yeah, I guess the ski resorts is actually a really good example, Dominic, because as you said, they have to change, right? And just to make this very clear, if they don't change, they're basically running out of snow. And hence, when you don't have snow, no ski resort. Yeah, that's very simple, very drastic.
It's a very simple equation. Yeah. But again, I think this shows very well that as soon as you face the danger and you face the problem, you are forced to change. And it's sadly, it's a little, yeah, we don't have much time to change right now. Huh?
Right, and I guess this is kind of the worry in a way, like, are we too late? You know, I think this has been coming up in the recent years.
It's never too late.
Right?
I agree with you. I agree with you. It's never too late. It's never too late. But we just lost 20 years. If you see again, I go back to Al Gore, because I think it was preeminent. And then you had it was a good momentum. You had DiCaprio, you had some good stars, you know, it was a very good momentum, and then it stopped. So we've lost 20 years.
Yeah, actually, I feel like we've lost more like 50 years, because the real environmental movement with Greenpeace and, you know, Sierra Club, and that was all in the 70s, right? And then, you know, we had Al Gore. It was kind of a blip forward, but then it went back. So I feel like it's actually been more like 50 years of an inactivity where carbon has just grown and grown and grown. I think that we've burned more carbon in the past 30 years than we have in all of human history.
Yes, that's what the number says, huh? Yeah. It's frightening. Okay. No, but we have good options. You know, when I see today people like Elon Musk with Tesla having such a momentum and also so successful with money. So this will also help, you know, because people see, okay, wow, you can be electric and make money. Okay, electric is maybe not the magical thing, but it goes in the right direction.
Yeah, it's definitely
so. It's much better. So as soon as you see people having success in that direction, making money, it's a good example, and I think this will accelerate the movement. Yeah.
But actually, I think since yesterday, Elon Musk is the most richest man on Earth. I don't know. You know, Elon certainly has developed a couple of really interesting stuff, and you know, for the U.S. to go electric cars, what a revolutionary idea. Sorry to be sarcastic sometimes, but you know. And then it really is the only incentive to do good money. Like, you know, like, where are we going? If this is the only incentive to like do a good business to make money, like this is a little bit short-sighted in my opinion, you know, but I know that this is how we still set things up.
Welcome to humanity.
and still
No, I agree, Stephanie. It's sad, but this is the way it is, huh? To me. As soon as it hits your wallet, or it's going to be more expensive, or then people will change their behavior. As long as gas and oil and fuel is cheaper, it will be very difficult to make them change. Yes. So to my point, it needs to be economic, and the economy can be driven by the politics. And if we have these two, I think today the population is ready to change. I mean, they already show. At their own level, at a personal level, they're making a lot of effort.
Well, I have another question, Dominic, which is maybe a little bit off topic, but I always wondered, right? Like when you described the feeling of going down these really deep slopes in the snow, right, as a skier. What is the thought in this moment when you basically, you know, you're making these decisions between life and death all the time, whether you go left or right? And then you like ski down. What is in your mind?
Oh, your mind at this moment when it works well, it's the best moment you can have. You know, it's like, it's really like being the right person at the right place at the right moment. And to make that together, it's a lot of work. But before you start your descent, it's a lot of preparation. You know, it's a lot of visualization first. You visualize the terrain, and you make the best line, the best scenario, you know, line one, everything is fine. Then you make maybe scenario two, something can be wrong here. So you already have everything in your head. Every scenario is prepared. You cannot go on and improvise. This is not possible. So the hard work is a preparation. But as soon as you're on top and you're ready to go, and you go, off you go, it's the most beautiful feeling you can have. I think it's like a musician, you know, when he plays part and everything just flows, or a painter, or a writer, when you just get the right words and it just flows. It's the same feeling. It's just, you're part of it. You're part of the whole thing. And that's beautiful. And this is why when you have a sport like this, you understand the nature, because for some moment you are part of it, you know, you're not just watching it, or no, you're part of that mountain. Therefore, you want to love it and you want to take care of it. And this is why for me it was very important to feel part of this world, you know. You're not just a human on visit, you're really part of it and you can make some changes. And that's the beauty of skiing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, beautiful. So it's basically this desire to be one, to become one with the universe, one with nature.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Which is so, I mean, this is basically also where not your films, don't make me, don't misunderstand me. It's not your film. Your films were always very different, right? But the marketing films about what you see about come go skiing, I think it's this desire to be in the deep snow, you know, be one with nature. And it feels so weird to me that at the same time we are losing nature. You know, we are not realistic about it. Like, we have this desire and dream about the perfect oneness and nature intact, and then at the same time, reality, we are pumping up the climate and we're losing it.
Yeah, but what you say is interesting, because the more we lose it, the more people want to go outdoor sports. Like this winter in the Alps and the last winter, we see an increase in ski touring, snowshoeing, even in summertime, hiking. So it's very interesting what you say, because it's like we understand we were completely disconnected, and a lot of people now, they have the almost a natural instinct to go back in the nature, to reconnect. And as soon as these people, they go into the wild, they go into this, you know, beautiful forest or sea, or they start thinking differently. And then because they feel part of it. So I think it's a balance, you know. The more we lose, we understand, oh, no, we need the nature. It's us, you know. It's a whole thing.
Dominic Perret. Off-piste, tackling the Alps and the Himalayas.
I think Dominic has been on pretty much all the mountains in the world where there's a bit of snow and where you can ski down on. I think that's what I know. You know, going to Afghanistan, I think, is for once not for military reasons. So just enjoy the mountains and the ski.
Yeah.
And the snow, and then all of a sudden you don't have snow. But
no, and a first-hand experience of the degradation of the environment,
right?
Over
exactly.
That time.
That's super interesting, you know, because there are not a lot of people to actually go to these places. I mean, this may sound very banal to you, but the kind of skiing Dominic did, or probably still does, is off-piste. It's really extreme,
which
conditions.
Means off the trail.
Off the trail. You shouldn't do that. Don't even try. No, I'm serious. Pretty dangerous. And it's actually becoming more and more dangerous because of the snow conditions and you can't, you know, avalanches more and more. Anyway, so, and then it's going down through the rocks and all these ice and, you know, you can break your leg and neck. So
just a bit on the crazy side.
Right. But he's seen firsthand 20 years ago that there's a massive change. It's not like a little bit of a change. It's massive change.
Yeah. I mean, just the story told about the, you know, 10 years ago, they were skiing the glaciers in the Alps. And then 10 years later, 100 meters of that has disappeared. Like literally 100 meters just poof, gone of pure glacial ice in the Alps. That's pretty graphic, you know, wow. You can't ski anymore. It's just air.
Right. I think there are other advocates in extreme sport, like Michael Schumacher, for example, who did a whole photo series in the Aletsch Glacier. Him in front of the Aletsch, and you could see how the Aletsch basically is disappearing in the background, right? And then they had him, and then comparison to other photos 100 years ago, where exact same spot. And you could basically say, oh, there's a huge, massive glacier there. And when Michael Schumacher was there, there's nothing there anymore, just an empty valley. And, you know, there is stuff like that, but it's kind of missing the personal experience. And I think this is what Dominic really does really nicely, is to talk about his personal experience. I also like the moment when he is in the flow and this connection to nature, which really makes us... Can I say human? Is that the right thing? I think it's this our human connection.
It makes us alive, like everything else.
Do you think animals have the same connection?
Well, I think that's what he's saying, is that he's suddenly part of the whole. He's part of all of living things.
He's connected to it all. Right?
Yeah.
He's part of the universe. And that dream, which is held up by, I want to be mean now, a kind of marketing type of, here's the desire, go skiing, buy this equipment, buy that helmet, you know, all that kind of thing is just a paper dream, really, if we are not keeping that nature alive and if we are not keeping our planet alive.
Yeah. Well, he also, for me, pointed to the very critical importance of documenting what we see and with the kind of passion that he documents, you know, it's important, document it and share it with the world, because not everyone sees these things. Not everyone sees these changes. And if you don't see them and you don't feel them, you don't react. But if you can see them and try to feel them, there's a chance of getting something else done.
We're an independent, listener-supported podcast.
Thanks to our producer, Riley Paul.
Support us by rating this episode and sharing with all your friends.
And to learn more,
join us at potofgold.world.
I'm Stephanie Overbach.
And I'm Mel Wymore.
Thanks for listening.